Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sacramento City Unified is still deciding when to end the school year, with just over 5 weeks until its planned summer break. The district faces a fine of $47 million by the state if it doesn't make up for days lost during a teacher and school staff strike earlier this year. Both the district and the Sacramento City Teachers Association are negotiating how to add instructional time to the school year. But a final decision has yet to be reached, with the clock ticking and families left in a limbo of summer plans. Sosun Marar is the Sacramento Bee's school accountability reporter and has been following these developments very closely. Good morning, Sosun.
Good morning, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start off and get the state requirements and laws out of the way. What are the requirements for districts, which is leading Sac City Unified, to be required to make up for days or face a fine of tens of millions of dollars?
Right. So school districts in California are required to have 180 days of instructional time. And the district, Sac City Unified, is usually at 181. This year they were at 181 days. But of course, we saw an 8-day strike, which brings them down below that mandatory 180 days.
So they have to make up 7 days at least.
Correct.
So what's being negotiated?
So there are several options. The district and the teachers union have gone back and forth on proposals. They considered extending Thursdays by 60 minutes to kind of make up for those instructional minutes. Also on the table is to include an additional week at the end of the school year. So right now, Sac City Unified has that Friday, June 17th, 17 off, and then they would go to school on that day and then also go to school from the 20th to the 24th. That's a proposal, of course, nothing official, but these are just some of the proposals on how to make up for that lost time.
Well, given that there are multiple options out there, what is the issue with making a final decision?
Well, there's a few things. The district says the biggest issue is staffing. They need to make sure that they have an adequate number of staff to basically run all of these schools, you know, to ensure that when students are being asked to go to school for an additional week that wasn't originally planned for, that we have enough teachers and staff to greet the students at the door and, continue on with instruction. So that's the main issue. Now, part of the proposal is to request that no more than 20% of the staff can take that time off. So, you know, if there are staff members that have already decided that they needed a surgery scheduled at that time or had something planned or, you know, took up another job or a vacation, only 20% of Sac City staff can, say that they are not able to work. So that's some back and forth on how to accommodate the schedule, but also to accommodate the staff.
Yeah, because there's just a little over 5 weeks left and expanding or extending it by a week, you know, can ruin some plans. What does the teachers union have to say about this? Because they're currently negotiating, you know, how to extend the school year.
Right. So the teachers union and the district are largely on the same page on how to address this. I mean, there's only so many ways to address this, right? Extend school days or extend the school calendar. But the teachers issue is concerned because the district says in the latest proposal that they'll not be liable for any taxes or retirement consequences as a result to this agreement. And so the school district officials, teachers union officials that I spoke with said that that sounds a bit punitive. So they're worried about what that looks like in the long term for teachers and their pay, which is how we got here to begin with, right? The strike was over teachers' pay, also, you know, staffing shortages. So that's one of the things that's holding up this deal as well.
What is the district's argument? What has the district been saying?
Well, the district, again, says that their main concern is staffing. And, really largely, my understanding is that both the district and the teachers union are pretty much in agreement on, you know, how to go ahead and extend the calendar. But it's really the issue is, you know, what will pay look like and how to ensure that teachers will be accommodated financially and adequately.
Yeah, because the devil's in the details, as always. What about SEIU Local 1021? Because they also went on strike. Does this impact them as well? And also, there's five collective bargaining groups. I mean, I guess how will all staff be impacted?
It would impact everyone. So we have to ensure that all of the schools are staffed adequately, and that would include SEIU. We have to ensure that, you know, lunches are provided that and that last week. We would have to ensure that janitorial services and bus services and, you know, all the things that and all the people that it takes to run schools, those folks need to be at the schools for that week. And this, you know, goes back to just making this reminder that this is not a final decision, right? There is a chance, a possible chance that, you know, this last week may never be tacked on to the end of the school year. Because again, we're just a few weeks, you know, towards the end of the school year and no decision has been made.
Yeah, and this has been talked about really since the beginning of the strike, which lasted for 8 days. Sosin, you've been following this incredibly closely. Is it surprising to you? Were you expecting a decision by now, or is it surprising to you that things are still being hashed out?
You know, that's a good question, Vicky. I think a lot of people are frustrated that a decision has not been made yet, but one criticism that this district gets over and over again is just how long you know, deals take to happen. And I think that is what we're seeing right now is that, you know, the original proposal, part of the original proposal was to include, you know, an extension of Thursdays. We can't really see that because how many Thursdays do we have to the end of the school year? So the fact that it's taking so long, I think, surprises many, but this has been the criticism for a while now that this district takes too long to move.
Yeah. How should families and parents, how should they be viewing what's happening? And when you talk to them, how do they feel about kind of being in limbo when it comes to a potential extension to the school year?
I've talked to several families in Sac City Unified, and, you know, many of them, I'd say most of the ones I spoke with, said that they would not agree to an extension and they would not be there for that last school week. A lot of them are saying that they've already enrolled in summer camps. They've already booked flights on vacations. One woman I spoke with said that she runs a summer camp and that she's worried that most of her students who are in Sac City Unified will not, you know, come and they'll ask for refunds, which could, you know, affect her financially. A lot of folks were frustrated at such a last minute decision that could come out and say, you know, your kids are locked in for another week. So it sounds like if this decision does go forward, it sounds like enrollment might be down that final week. And, you know, what's the benefit?
Yeah. And this is just on top of overall burnout, you know, and because even during a strike, not to mention, you know, just an incredibly arduous 2 years for families, for teachers, for staff. I mean, are you kind of sensing, is that palpable to you when you're talking to so many different viewpoints from families to school staff, to teachers, to even the district?
I am. I think a few, you know, months ago or a year ago, you might have families that will say, sure, you know, we'll want an extra week. Let's get that, you know, that time in for our kids who've lost so much. But I think a lot of families are just really frustrated, you know, with COVID, with the back and forth during the strike. And they just really want a relaxing vacation or just time off with their children. So I did sense a lot of that frustration. And also, you know, I think a lot of families that I've also spoken with have talked about how they feel that their children are being punished in a way. They're saying that, you know, why do we have to change our summer schedules for delays that happened in the district or negotiations that took too long during this 8-day strike? So they feel that they ended up being punished, for lack of a better word, punished and, you know, with a shorter summer break and, you know, to quickly change their plans. They say that's just completely unfair.
Yeah. And I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, students returned to class after the strike. People went back to work. But what is outstanding? What is left to be discussed in maybe in the next school year?
Well, one thing that'll be left to discuss is how to address this, you know, $47 million penalty if it doesn't get addressed this year. So, you know, school districts do have some time to make up for lost time, but the concern is because this was over a strike, there is a need to get this, you know, recovered, these missing days recovered as soon as possible. But, you know, there could be a chance that if this doesn't get addressed, it might be addressed next year. So that's something that'll come up in the next school year as well.
What's next for you, Sosin? I mean, you've been following this so closely for well over a year now.
Right. So I think what we'll continue to do at the B is continue speaking to the district and the union and get a sense of, you know, what this means for families. I think that we're seeing a lot of families who are, you know, frustrated. There's a concern about declining enrollment in the school district. Is this the cherry on top for some families that are so frustrated that they might consider other school districts or other schools over the summer? So we're just continuing to follow those conversations and see how these things will continue to affect our community.
So thanks for joining us and explaining all of that.
Thank you for having me.
Sosin Marar is the Sacramento Bee School Accountability Reporter, updating a potential extension to Sac City Unified school year following a teacher and staff strike. Up next, we'll meet the founder of Imported Comedy, which showcases immigrants and stand-up comedians of color. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Comedy is anything but a straight line. It is subjective, awkward, at times cringeworthy, and has the power to be introspective and observant in a blatant, honest way we probably shy away from outside a late night stage with a 2-drink minimum. But it is so liberating because the best comedians are fueled by lived experience to speak truth. This weekend in Sacramento, a stand-up lineup is showcasing immigrant voices, each with a uniquely personal perspective in pursuit of creativity and laughs. The show is called Imported Comedy, and the latest show will be at the Sacramento Comedy Spot this Friday. Joining us is co-creator and host Mikhail Chernofsky. Mikhail, welcome.
Thank you, Vicky. It's really exciting to be here.
All right. Well, let's start from the beginning. What got you into comedy?
Comedy was one of those things I grew up watching when my parents weren't around. I grew up, I was fortunate enough to grow up kind of in the heyday of HBO comedy and the half hour specials. So it was one of those things that I would always sneak off and watch when I was a kid, probably exposed to a lot of jokes I shouldn't have heard at a young age. And as soon as I turned 18, I started hitting the stage wherever they would let me go on.
Yeah, like a little delirious. I remember that when I was not supposed when I was not supposed to watch that, but it's hilarious. When you actually began pursuing a career in comedy, what did you see that was missing?
That's a great question. That's for us, for my co-creator and I, we really felt that there was just there's just a missing voice in the diversity of the stand-up that we were exposed to in our communities and in around the areas. And we just really felt like, I felt personally, as an immigrant in this country, who blends in pretty well. I don't have an accent that's clearly recognizable. And so I always felt like I didn't really have a place that fit in. I was always kind of, in this in-between space of not really fitting into a binary definition of, of a type of comedian. And it was really important for me to start showcasing, immigrant voices like myself and first generation Americans as well, and people of color, and just really trying to represent the diversity of our communities, the diversity of not just people, but all the cultures that make up our communities, specifically here in this greater Sacramento area, but as well as our country as a whole. I grew up with the concept that we are a melting pot of cultures, and I really wanted to showcase that in a way that we just weren't really seeing in a lot of stand-up shows.
We've been having a lot of conversations about this, about the lack of diversity in creative fields. I mean, just yesterday we talked about publishing and children's books with an author. From your experience, why has comedy historically lacked diverse voices?
It's hard for me to really speak into that and just say, you know, I think, you know, it's easy to chalk it up to, you know, there are always gatekeepers and, you know, they're, you know, from my experience as an actor, you know, a lot of places are looking for a type. They're trying to cast for things. And I think sometimes when you don't have something that is so clear cut of this is what it is, it's sometimes kind of hard for people to market it or, you know, to present it. And so again, for us, it was really, we're intentionally trying to do something different. We're intentionally trying to put on comedians that aren't necessarily getting booked on regular themed shows. And we're really also just trying to show we're trying to show that thread between people that no matter what cultures we come from, at the end of the day, we're all looking for the same thing. You know, at the end of the day, we're all struggling with the same things. You know, as much as we love our parents, we all have family issues. And, you know, and that's, those kinds of themes are underlying regardless of where or from what culture you come from.
Yeah. And it's also just an evolution. I'm curious, what comedians did you look up to growing up? And how has that changed as you've grown as a comedian? Who do you admire now compared to, you know, when you were a child or younger?
I grew up with a lot of storytellers. For me, you mentioned Delirious, right? You know, so like for me, I grew up with, you know, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy. And then on the flip side, you know, I was a huge Carlin fan. I loved these comedians who could tell stories, who could not just, not just overinflate a joke, but really just bring a story to life and then take it to a next level and really express a very deep idea. And I continue to really enjoy, you know, comedians that are pushing those boundaries. At the same time, I really enjoy comedians that are just doing off the wall stuff. Of course, I'm going to start blinking on names.
There are plenty to choose from. I understand. I hate being put on the spot, too. When it comes to the show Imported Comedy, help us visualize what a show is like.
I mean, you know, as far as the show, I think, you know, you're not going to find a lot of surprises as far as, when you go to a stand-up show, you can expect a lot of the same things. It's, you know, it's comedians in front of microphones telling jokes. What you're going to see at our show that's a little more different is we're intentionally showcasing a much more diverse lineup. We don't only host immigrant comedians. Like, as you mentioned, we do a much broader spectrum, and really it's leaning into that, you know, so much of the culture and life and beauty of this country has been brought in and imported from all over the world. And so for us leaning into that, we really get to celebrate that diversity. Whether we're having Hispanic stand-up comedians to African Americans, refugees such as myself, we really try to do our best to grab a great wide band, wide range of comedians that we can showcase on the show. And I think that's the real difference you're going to see.
I would imagine there have just been particularly special moments where that really hit you and you realize that this is special.
Yeah, that's, it's so funny you say that, because that's something my co-creator Derek and I are always talking about, and how the feedback and the support for the show has just been incredible, not only from the comedians in our communities, but the audiences themselves. We've only been doing the show for a couple of years, but to see how quickly we've been growing and, you know, the example being that tomorrow night at the Sacramento Comedy Spot, we're going to be kicking off a 3-month residency. And so it's just, you know, to have venues and performers and then the audience really lifting up this show and giving it that support has just been incredible.
What has been just the biggest, it's one thing to, you know, to love comedy, you know, as a child or someone younger, and then to actually stand on a stage to then also creating, you know, a comedy ensemble. What was the biggest challenge transforming imported comedy from just an idea to a stand-up ensemble?
I mean, honestly, I think I don't know if it was a challenge. And I think maybe that's really one of the truly surprising things of this show is how easy it has been to put it together, to bring it to life on stage. I mean, part of it, it's amazing to me how quickly Derek and I were able to go from having a conversation in my garage and going, what can we do? What kind of show can we put on? And then, you know, calling on our community, calling on comedians, and just being able to book it and get it on stage has just been such an incredible ride. And I don't feel like it's been hard in that this is not an idea I'm having to beg people to get behind.
Yeah. And not only are you're giving it to others, to an audience, but I would imagine you learn a great deal from your fellow comedians.
Absolutely. And like I said, I mean, for us, one of the underlying goals of this is to really show the connecting themes across all these people and all these cultures. And I love hearing their jokes and their stories. And you're just, you know, you're always surprised at how you can relate to somebody else that can look absolutely nothing like you. And I think that is truly the greatest victory of the show for me.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Mikhail Chernovsky, the co-creator of Imported Comedy, showcasing immigrant comedians in Sacramento. Mikhail, I think your co-creator is here, Derek. Correct, Derek? Are you around?
He is. How's it going, buddy?
Good comedy morning to you. Hello. Hi, Vicky. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Well, Mikhail was just talking about imported comedy. I'm curious, when the two of you were mulling over this idea, did you imagine it would have the trajectory the trajectory that it's had over the last few years?
We set a challenge of trying to book an all immigrant comedy show, and we found out within two shows it was really easy to do. And then it was a fun discovery that same venue had never had an all-Black show in the, like, 10 years they had been open. And so we thought we'd do a Black History Month February excuse to do a Black show, you know, of imported comedy there. And it's been surprisingly easy to find immigrants of different colors that are telling their story. You know, they're all around. You know, there's a lot of immigrant comedians.
Yeah. I asked Mikhail this. I'm just curious, what got you started into comedy?
I honestly always wanted to do it. It was always my dream. I was genuinely, I had been doing theater for a long time, but I was scared to do stand-up. You know, I was, you know, being in my early 20s, like I was not living the best life. And so I was afraid to go on stage and be my honest self because I wasn't that proud of myself. You know, and so it took me being more loving and kind to myself in offstage life to then be able to do comedy as a version of myself that I liked and was proud of. But I always wanted to do stand-up. I met Mikhail, and once Mikhail and I became friends, I started to see that it wasn't such a big, scary, giant HBO thing, that it's like you can play to.
Yeah. What do you want people to take away from imported comedy?
Our success of the show, the thing we are in love with about the show, is the intersection between American people of color and Americans and immigrants, that we have a shared culture, that we have a shared story.
Mikhail, what do you want people to take away? Especially a lot of them are going to go see you on Friday.
I would echo what Derek has said. I mean, it really, you know, it really is for us kind of a mission to show the, you know, the connecting thread of all of our stories and how we do have this shared culture, a shared story. And, you know, we are all part of a shared community. And, you know, if outside of that, you know, I hope people, you know, walk away laughing and, you know, having jokes and stories that they can share with their friends afterwards. And I can only hope that they want to come back to another show.
Yeah, you mentioned, Mikhail, I mean, you're a refugee, you're a Ukrainian immigrant. Your father is in Poland helping refugees. He has been a guest on Insight. He actually just emailed me earlier this week. He's still there. We did an interview with him when he was on a train in Poland, traveling in between providing supplies to others. How has this war and also your father's dedication shaped your comedy?
I think the biggest impact is I can finally really talk about being Ukrainian. You know, for so long, I just kind of threw a blanket label over myself as just, you know, a Soviet, a Russian, you know, and so I've leaned into that kind of material so much more. Where now, you know, unfortunately, it took a war for people to realize there is a difference between Russians and Ukrainians. And I think that's one of the, you know, in a hard way, that's one of the liberating things of the current situation, is that I do have more of a platform in order to talk about, you know, who I truly am and where I truly come from in a more specific, direct way. But outside of that, I think it's just, you know, this is a really good opportunity to help people remember that, you know, these things are happening all over the world, these tragedies, these moments in time. And it's important that, you know, that we can rise up and bring a voice to these times. And so I think it's just, you know, I'm so proud of my dad that he's able to go over there and volunteer and help the people, and, you know, not just our friends and family that are still there, but, you know, the people that are truly just, you know, that I share a story with. You know, my family came here as refugees, escaping the Soviet Union. We came here with nothing. And, you know, a lot of the same people are going through those same things. And we, you know, I can only hope that we can continue to bring a voice to them. And if you do come to the imported shows, we are, you know, you'll see our flyers with QR codes to help in any way that you can to donate to the people of Ukraine and help this effort. And I can only hope that this is just a building block for a future that we as people collectively rise up and help one another, regardless of where we come from.
When did you learn that comedy is a powerful and cathartic solution during adversity and pain?
It's something I've had to learn and my entire life. You know, I mean, stereotypically, you know, comedy became a defense mechanism for me as a young kid getting bullied. You know, it's, you know, I grew up in America in the 90s and, you know, in a post-Cold War era. So I've been so used to hearing, you know, commie type jokes against myself. You know, I'm also Jewish, so I'm used to receiving, you know, that kind of negative attention. And so for me, it's just that comedy has always been a place of refuge to take back the hate and take ownership over it. And really, if I can laugh at the hard stuff, and if I can learn to laugh at the hard things that I'm faced with in my life, I can only hope that my jokes and my humor can help people realize that we can all eventually get over the hurt and the pain that comes with this life. But also remember that there's just so much beauty still on the other side of it all.
Yeah. I mean, life doesn't stop. And Derek, I mean, that brings me to you. I mean, how did the lack of performing in front of a live audience shape your material? And what has inspired you over the past 2+ years?
A fun thing that I found during the pandemic, there were, you know, some great leaders in the comedy community that were using the confines to make something beautiful, you know. So over Facebook, there was a group called The Workshop, where a buddy of mine, you know, this, we became friends. He was doing nightly open mics with giving people suggestions, you know, giving people a prompt for them to write 3 to 5 minutes to. And then so people would write new jokes from that and then bring 5 minutes of their own material and then do those jokes over Zoom just like this with 4 to 5 other comics. And then they would give each other notes after their sets. So I fortunately did that at least once a month during the pandy, and that was super fun. I also had the privilege
of— I like the pandy. I like that.
That's a Bobby Lee-ism, you know? That's me stealing something from another comedian. Yeah, the pandy. And this is my first pandy. You know, I'm just starting to get good at it. You know, I'm just figuring it out. Yeah, that's pandy in a sentence. Yeah, I mean, during the pandy, you know, I really enjoyed working with Mikhail because Mikhail and I both started as actors before doing stand-up. And so both of us like writing our jokes as poems in a way, you know, it's this thing that we think is beautiful and fascinating. And then we just kind of perform this poem, this thesis of an idea that we have been dying to aim at people, you know? And so, over this break of a pandemic, Mikhail and I both came out of it with a good chunk of stuff we needed to say, you know, stuff we were excited to talk about.
All right. Finally, people can't make Friday. You have other shows, right? Other dates in the weeks to come?
Monthly.
Yeah. So, yeah, as we mentioned, tomorrow night, May 13th, Friday the 13th, always a lucky day. We're kicking off our 3-month residency at the Sacramento Comedy Spot, which is down at the Mars Building. So we'll be there for the next 3 months on the second Friday of every month. So the 13th is tomorrow. And oh man, I should have written down all the dates, but
we have a link on our website so people can get
more. So yeah, we'll be there through July.
That's great. Derek and Mikhail, thank you so much for spending time with us. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Thank you, Vicky.
It is. Thank you so much.
Mikhail Chernofsky and Derek Dozier are the co-creators of Imported Comedy, which promotes new and diverse voices in stand-up comedy by showcasing immigrants, children of immigrants, and out-of-this-world thinkers. Their latest show will be at the Sacramento Comedy Spot on Friday. Still ahead, an AC/DC tribute band rocks out with its own twist. Gay/CDC rolls into Sacramento with their high voltage performance. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. What do you think of when you hear the band AC/DC? Loud rock music, heavy metal, hot, sweaty mosh pits, and huge sold-out stadiums around the world? You would be right. In fact, AC/DC, which first formed in the late 70s in Australia, have sold more than 200 million records worldwide, making them the 9th highest-selling artist or band in the United States and 16th worldwide. The album Back to Black is their bestseller and plays at bars on jukeboxes across the world. Well, if you're a fan of AC/DC or just a fan of rock music, you're in for a treat Saturday night in Sacramento as an AC/DC tribute band is rolling into town at Harlow's, but with a twist. The tribute band comes with several pink boas and lots of fun costumes. The group is called Gacy/DC, and here's a quick listen. All right, as you might imagine, Gacy/DC is a group of gay men who are diehard AC/DC fans, and they can belt out their songs and put on a show unlike any that you have likely seen. Joining us to talk about their passion for AC/DC and Saturday Night Show are two of the band stars, Chris Freeman and Brian Welch. Chris is the founder of Gacy/DC and the band's bass player. Brian is Gacy/DC's drummer. Thank you for joining us today. We know you're on the road.
Actually, yeah, we're just about to leave. Like right after this, I'm going to hop in the RV and get started.
Yeah, y'all have a show in Portland tomorrow night, and then you'll be here in Sacramento on Saturday. You know, Brian, tell us how Gacy/DC came about.
Chris and I were in a previous band, an all-gay tribute to the Go-Go's called the Gay Gays. And that was ending. But Chris and myself and the guitarist still wanted to play. We had such a great time. And one of the very last rehearsals, our guitarist just started doing the riff to Back in Black. And Chris was like, well, what else can we do? And Carl, the guitarist, kept doing this riff. And I looked at Chris and Carl looked up and said, Gacy/DC. And the three of us just had one of those aha moments. Like we saw the light bulb come on over each other's heads. And we said, there's no way that doesn't exist already. So once we realized that it did not exist, we put the wheels in motion, and within 20 minutes, Chris, who was the bass player for the Gay Gays, but is now the singer for Gacy/DC, Chris kind of had the whole idea with the logo, what it was going to look like, and then we all talked about what we wanted we wanted to make sure that we did the music spot on, but we didn't want to look like them. We wanted to be ourselves. We wanted to be the band we wish we have would seen growing up as gay, young gay kids. So we said, we're going to put on a show. And Chris had some amazing ideas. And it took about a year, and we finally got it together and did our first gig. We thought we'd just play for some friends. Maybe we'd play a bar here and there. 10 years later, next year will be our 10th year anniversary. We're still doing it, and we're touring. So completely not what we expected.
Yeah, that is just incredible. Chris, what's the most rewarding part of Gacy/DC over the last 10 years?
Well, I think it's just liberating for everybody. We really use the music as a vehicle to disarm people. I think that once they, you know, the whole idea is, oh, you know, if they're all gay, what's the point? You know, why would you do that? Well, the point is, you know, we want to be visible. Like Brian said, we want to be the band we wanted to see. Well, we're adding to the visibility of gay people being in rock music instead of just necessarily like disco or techno or something. So we're showing our love of AC/DC that we grew up with. And also showing that that we're gay and that it's okay to be gay. And I think right now, that's an especially important message.
Yeah. What is the emotional connection you have with AC/DC?
Well, I grew up hearing the radio. I'm 60 now. So I grew up listening to, you know, hearing certain songs, like I heard It's a Long Way to the Top on the radio. And there's this band called AC/DC, you know, and then one night radio stations used to play an entire album like on their release date. So they play the entire record. So one night I was listening to the radio and they said, OK, we're going to play Let There Be Rock, the new album by AC/DC. And I sat there and listened to it, and I was just mesmerized. I just fell in love instantly. And then I saw the album cover, and it was just amazing as well. And at the time, they were kind of considered punk because the actual song, Let There Be Rock, in 1977, songs were just not that fast, except if they were considered punk, like, or like maybe a Motorhead kind of style. But that was a very fast song. So I really fell in love right at that point.
Yeah. What about you, Brian? What are your favorite memories of taking in AC/DC in the very beginning?
Like Chris, I heard them on the radio, but I was a little late to the game. I joined during the Brian Johnson era when Back in Black came out, and that's the album that really turned my head. But I saw them for the first time at Boston Garden on the For Those About to Rock tour, and I went with a bunch of high school friends. I knew I loved the band, but it was the crowd reaction that got me. It was seeing them right there do all these songs that I love, but it was feeling part of a community at that show, feeling like it didn't matter if you were young, old, fat, skinny, black, white, brown. Everyone was there to take part in this celebration of music. And I'd never experienced anything like that. I'd seen some shows before, but an AC/DC crowd was different. It was just people that absolutely loved the music, and you could tell the band loved their fans. And that was an amazing emotional moment for me. And I've loved them ever since.
Yeah, I've actually watched their performances on YouTube, which is great because they were from decades ago, and you could just feel the energy. It's just such an epic performance. And I just was like, anyone who went is just so lucky to be part of that collective energy. You know, so we're going to listen to some of your music. Your shows are high energy, lots of costume changes, fun and wild. But before we take a listen, help us visualize what a live show is like, Chris.
So one of the things Brian mentioned earlier was that we didn't want to do the presentation because you've got enough AC/DC tribute bands that the people look far more like the actual band members than we do. So we went the opposite direction. Instead of black t-shirts and jeans, we went with full-on sequins and boas and just craziness. So makeup. So it's not that, you know, it's not the two-dimensional sort of just in your faceness of AC/DC. It's really colorful, very colorful. And we leave a mess because there's confetti, there's all sorts of unknown substances that find their way onto the stage. It's just a wild, crazy kind of, you know, one of the things I also liked was when rock was a little dangerous, you know, like the band was like, you don't know exactly what could happen. Like Iggy Pop, for example. So we are definitely pushing the envelope.
All right, let's listen to Highway to Hell. What goes into achieving, you know, that sound, you know, when you're actually in a tribute band? What goes into all of that? There must be an incredible amount of work.
It is a lot of work. You know, a lot of people think AC/DC is very simple music. And on its surface, yeah, it's very simple. But when you get down to the details, there's a swing that's in there that's very hard to match. And there's a whole rhythm thing between the guitars because they're brothers. I mean, you can't, that synchronicity is very hard to duplicate. And it takes hours. That's why Brian said it took us almost a year before we were ready to kind of come out and do it, because we really wanted to get that engine going the way they have it. So it felt completely right.
Brian, please go ahead, Brian.
One of the other things that we wanted to do right from the beginning was to change the lyrics and have fun. We wanted to do the music absolutely spot on, the way that people know it and remember it and love it. But we wanted to change the lyrics and have fun with it. So when people come to shows, if they're not familiar with our lyrics, they're in for a treat, because they start singing along, but then they realize that's actually not what we're singing. And then it makes them listen. And Chris said, our aim is to disarm people, right? And to have them have fun with it. And I think once they start singing along to the lyrics, the new lyrics, they have a lot of fun with it.
Go ahead, Chris, please take it away.
It's always fun to look out in the audience and see people like, oh, what did he just say? That's always a really fun moment for me. But there's also songs where we didn't have to change the lyrics. It's just the fact that maybe a guy in a dress up on stage singing those lyrics changes the context so much that it sounds like maybe I'm singing something else.
Yeah. That was going to be my question. What kind of audiences do you attract to your shows?
I think we attract an open-minded crowd. So people that are really into a good time and they just want to rock out and have a good time. So a lot of women, honestly. It's almost like we're a bachelorette party. So I think women really respond very well to it. And, you know, once the guys see that the women are into it, the ones that are a little offish, and then they start to laugh and get disarmed, then those people have a good time too. So anybody that loves AC/DC, by the way, if you are into the band at any point, please come and see us, because you're going to really enjoy the music as well.
All right, let's listen to another cover. This is the AC/DC classic, Shoot to Thrill. I keep going back to you all coming up with this idea nearly a decade ago, and here you are, you're on tour, and you have such a positive and wide reception. Do you ever have like a moment where you kind of like still pinch yourself that like you're just so happy you came up with the idea in the first place and did all the work?
Every show.
All the time.
Every show. We're so grateful and thankful that we get to do this. And, you know, the one of the positive results that we would never have seen coming is that we've been able to change people's perceptions about LGBT community and their reactions to gay people. We've had people who have completely turned around, who are homophobes, who now embrace their family members and have become fans and come to shows. So that's something we never would have seen coming. And so every show before we play, I'm thankful that we get to do this.
I see you nodding, Chris.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. Yes. You know, anytime you get people that are that will come to see you, that is a privilege, right? So it's just, you know, if people are interested enough in what you're doing and they come to see you, it's I'm always so grateful.
Well, I want to thank the both of you for taking the time during your busy tour schedule. Chris and Brian, thank you so much. Chris Freeman is the founder of Gacy DC and the band's bass player and singer. Brian Welch is Gacy DC's drummer. They are going to be playing at Harlow's on Saturday night. We have information on our Insight page at capradio.org. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. There's lots to do, lots of opportunities out there. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.